The views expressed on the Final Straw Radio do not necessarily reflect those of Asheville FM, WSFM LP Asheville, or Friends of Community Radio.
You're listening to Asheville FM at WSFM LP at 103.3 FM in Asheville, North Carolina. This is The Final Straw, and I'm William Goodenough.
And I'm Bursa Goodness.
The Final Straw can also be heard on KXCF in Marshall, California, KOWALP in Olympia, Washington, WCRSLP in Columbus, Ohio, KWTF in Bodega Bay, California, and Berkeley Liberation Radio. Archives of The Final Straw can be found at thefinalstrawradio.noblogs.org, where you can explore our 5 years of past programming, and you can write to us with questions or comments at thefinalstrawradio@riseup.net.
You can also follow us on most of the nasty social media you can think of for show announcements and related topics. This week we're featuring an interview with Steve from the Inside Outside Alliance. Steve talks about the current situation at the Durham County Jail in North Carolina, where inmates are suffering from a lack of clarity on policies and a recession of rights and privileges. Around the DJC, family members and friends on the outside are working with folks on the inside to push back and improve conditions while attempting to question incarceration as a whole. After that segment, we'll hear a couple of metal and punk tracks.
What you say, what you say, what you say, what? We're caught like a bomb.
A corrections officer who listens to the Final Straw broadcast religiously told me once that corrections officers are part of the 99%. You know, the 99%, the broad majority that Occupy brilliantly claimed to represent. In contrast to the privileged 1%, this corrections officer made a very similar argument to the one presented by Billy Joe Asclown, lead singer of the poser band Green Douche. Billy Joe claimed that police are part of the 99%. In one sense, this is seemingly true. Cops and guards are union members. They make a wage for their labor. They live on the same streets as teachers and plumbers and sanitation workers. None of them live in lavish homes and gated communities along with the world's ruling elite. Cops and guards, by this standard, are just working stiffs just like everyone else. Except they're not. Look, to some greater or lesser degree, we all keep the slavery system running. All of us. I get that. We're all plugged in. Forced to drag stones up the side of the pyramid for food rewards. We all work and chop and die. The system, in that sense, has all of us hugging our own chains and digging our own graves, whether we like it or not. There's just no getting around it. But in the case of cops and guards, we're dealing with a special case of keeping the system going, one that trumps their union membership and their wage labor class identification. While cops and guards might be economically part of the 99%, they are also openly and unapologetically waving pom-poms for the 1%. Some necessary history here. Police didn't exist in the U.S. until the Fugitive Slave Act. With the advent of slave laws, private groups largely composed of clansmen chased down escaped slaves and returned them to the slave masters, serving the profit margins of the land-owning 1%, the aristocracy, at the expense of the poor and desperate and enslaved. The word cop comes from copper, from the Latin capere, which means to catch or to capture. These vigilant clan groups were incorporated into public jobs as police, serving the interests of the wealthy, privileged 1%. At the end of slavery, prisons became the new plantations, and the prison boom was accompanied by a boom in prison jobs, where police arose from slave catchers, guards arose from slave managers.
This call is originating from an Ohio correctional facility and may be recorded and monitored.
The prisons employ the same element of poor whites who used to crack the whip on the plantation. So, from the beginning, the role of the cop and the guard is to betray their economic class in order to serve the ruling 1%. This explains why cops, who themselves are unionized, are often sent to crack the skulls of striking workers. It explains how a union hero like Joe Hill was arrested by cops and executed by prison guards, whose true loyalties are the privileged and the wealthy. But cops and guards don't just betray their economic class, they betray themselves. The unions of both cops and guards willingly abide by no-strike clauses, where they agree to not employ the only real leverage that workers have. In agreeing to never strike, cops and guards unions put the interests of the state and the interests of the cops and guards, and the cops and guards go along with it. This means cops and guards would rather take pay cuts, take food out of their mouths of the children, eliminate their own kids' college opportunities, than inconvenience the state and the oligarchy that the state serves. That's just pathetic. As a consequence of their spineless surrender in the interest of the 1%, prison guards in Ohio sit on their hands while the governor privatizes more and more of their jobs, chopping away at their union members, while their former co-workers take jobs at half the pay rate. This continues until soon the state can completely crush the union by mass privatizing, and still the guards won't strike. They love their slave masters more than they love their own kids. We're real members of the 99% that say, give us justice or we'll go on strike. Cops and guards say, give us justice or we'll go to work really, really sad. Their worship of the state prevents them from acting in their own self-interest, unlike all other workers who are just part of the 99%. Even now on the verge of having their union dismantled, the vast majority of them facing an eventual 50% pay cut, they still won't wildcat strike and exercise the power of worker solidarity. They would rather be reduced to crumbs while the state maintains repression complexes on the cheap. Their surrender of their own interests affords the state the luxury of maintaining the sprawling complex, keeping millions locked up for decades, including me. It facilitates a lot of terrible consequences for all of us. If cops and guards really want to be part of the 99%, they should go on strike. They could wildcat strike today and stick it to the state and the corrupt union leadership that sells them out at every turn. That would be a beginning, anyway, and of renouncing their allegiance to the 1%. Better yet, they could quit their jobs and convince everyone working with them to quit too. That's an even better beginning. Then they won't be acting as our enemy, forcing us to take them out when the next rebellion comes. But if they don't strike...
This call is originating from an Ohio correctional facility and may be recorded and monitored.
But if they don't strike and they don't quit, they're legitimate targets. This is anarchist prisoner Sean Swain from somewhere inside the American torture complex. If you're listening, you are the resistance.
You can write to Sean Swain at Sean Swain 243-205, P.O. Box 45699, 1724 State Route number 728, Lucasville, Ohio 45699. To read some of Sean's writings and learn more about his case, check out seanswain.org. Would you be so kind as to introduce yourself for the listening audience?
Sure. My name's Steve. I'm with a group that calls itself Inside Outside Alliance, and we are a group that is in communication with lots of folks in the Durham County Jail. We have other things that we do, but that's one of the prime things that we do as a group, and we also connect to lots of folks who have people inside the jail, and you know, they are part of our growing group as well.
And what's going on in the Durham County Jail right now? And can you give us background on the lockback situation? And also, what does lockback mean?
Sure. I think I'll talk about what lockback means first. Lockback is a sort of a kind of a catch-all. I mean, it's something that inmates at the jail can use when they're talking about 23-1, so, you know, 23 hours in cell and 1 hour out. But what we're referring to with lockback and what has happened in the past is, for whatever reasons that the jail administration comes up with, people are placed on lockback. So maybe a certain pod might be on lockback, so they're not allowed out of cells to the usual amount of time that they are. But what is going on right now, what has been going on since early March, is that the entire jail, so all the pods in the jail, are under lockback. And what that has meant is, from early on in March, it meant that basically inmates were allowed out of cell for 2 hours every 2 to 3 days. So what that meant was they had like a kind of a rolling time out where they would allow maybe up to 6 people out at a time, but it would be at all kinds of times of day. So one of the ways that we heard about this was a family who came to us and said that, you know, they were getting calls from their father at 1 a.m. And so people would be allowed out of their cells for their 2 hours, which happened to, you know, happen every 3 days or so. They would get a call at like 2 a.m. or 1 a.m, and that would happen to be that person's time out of cell. And, you know, they would be allowed to take a shower at that time, make phone calls, and do whatever they could do outside of the cell. I should also say that inmates are not allowed to have pencils inside their cells and haven't been for a long time, and so they're not even able to write letters in their cells. So anyway, since early March, that has been the case since we started protesting, which we'll talk a little bit about later, I suppose, that has changed slightly. And so they've made gradual easing of the lockback, you might say, where they're allowing more people out at a time. So I think about 8, and maybe now it's 10 or 11 or 12 people out at a time. And it was happening every other day. And then now, since late May, it's been happening every day that people are allowed out of cell. So it's 2 hours out of cell every day. But you contrast that with at least 6.5 or 7 hours that previously were allowed out of cell to do any number of things. Quite a difference, and as you can imagine, would have pretty terrible effects on human beings.
Can you talk about some of the impacts of lockback on the prisoners' social, physical, and mental health?
One of the things that we've heard a number of times from inmates or, you know, from people's families is that people have been driven to the point where they want to kill themselves. So that is obviously the most horrible and drastic effect that this lockback has had on people. And there have been at least 3 or 4 of those attempts that people have made. I mean, we're talking about, we know people who actually saw someone trying to take their life, and we're not able to. But you know, so that's one of the things. As far as physical health, I mean, we're in touch with a person who has is unable to exercise and is really talks about the deleterious effects that has on her well-being and what that does to, you know, to her psychically as well as physically. And then, you know, any number of people talk about, you know, not being able to exercise, not being able to socialize with other people. So, and obviously in science, they talk about not being in touch with other people and the effects that, you know, isolation or solitary confinement can have on people. And while this might not qualify as that exactly, it has the same kind of effect. And certainly there's more effects socially and mentally. And mentally, as far as mental health, I mean, that's already a problem. As far as the jail goes, the mental health provider that is contracted by the jail is one that partially works for free or voluntarily, and so that there's not really robust mental health services that are available for people before the lockback, and you know, nobody is getting seen regularly by any mental health professional now that people are under lockback. So it's just been driven to the point where, you know, people are in really bad shape, both physically and mentally.
And I've been told before that in a number of cases, one could say pretty across the board that people who are imprisoned per capita tend to have more mental health issues in a lot of cases, and that's why they get, like, rather than actually getting treatment for issues that they've got, they get pulled in by the police. The police are the first responders rather than some sort of de-escalation and, like, offer of medical or mental help. So it seems like this kind of situation would exacerbate the case of individuals who are not getting the proper treatment, right?
Yeah, definitely. Definitely. People are not getting any treatment, and you know, their treatment originally was getting put in jail, and then a person recently I was talking to this person outside of the jail. She had just gotten out, and she said, you know, how can it be anything but horrible for a human being to look at gray walls for 22 hours a day when they're already. And she was a young person and was talking about the high amount of anxiety and sort of mental health issues that she sees a lot of young people having. And she was saying, how could it be anything but horrible for a person to then be put in a situation where all they're looking at is, you know, brain walls all the time and maybe one other person, and they don't have any choice about who that person is. So, yeah, definitely it makes it much worse.
What's the administration's justification for the lockback in the Durham County Jail?
We've heard a number of different things, and in fact, a number of things have come out in the media as to why. And if a person was enterprising and kind of looked at some media articles about the lockback situation, you'll see that the Lieutenant Colonel Perkins, who's the head of the jail, even though, you know, she's under the sheriff's office, Sheriff Mike Andrews, but Lieutenant Colonel Perkins said at one point that it was a really terrible situation. You had gang members and people in the same gang fighting each other. And then in another news article, she was quoted as saying, it was a terrible situation. People were ganging up with each other against the guards. So it was like, well, which is it? You know, it was a completely contradictory statement that was made. And certainly, maybe you could say that was, you know, could be attributed to media incompetence or whatever, but you know, they were direct quotes, so I don't really know that that was the case. In any case, they've since sort of tried to make their story be more consistent, and what it's been has been that they found improvised weapons, a number of improvised weapons at first, and again, so some of this has been, you know, hearsay through people we know, and then others, other parts of it have come out in the media. First, it was just like one or two, and then it was like there was a number given to it, like 18 to 20. She's the jail head. Perkins is very sort of liberal with numbers. Is sort of like she might say 18 to 20 or 5 to 6 books that people are allowed, and then the next time you ask, it's like 3 to 4. Well, which is it? You know. So anyway, the justification was that they found these weapons and there were threats made to DOs, detention officers. So that is why we've had to do this, for the safety of all staff as well as all of the inmates at the jail. So that has been their sort of mantra in the weeks going forward as we've put pressure on by having protests and doing various other things. So it's been about safety that, you know, that they... the reasons that they give.
They've also responded in the media that they're actually higher than the state standards and requirements for access to outside of one cell, right?
That is true. Yeah, and they seem to take some kind of pride in that. You know, that is nothing to be proud of. And, you know, in fact, it's not something that we, as a grouping of people who have come together around the lockback, not something that we're, you know, responding to, because we don't necessarily care what the state regulations are. They actually, the jail, believes and acts as if it can have its own rules at any given day. You know, so they don't actually have any standard that they hold themselves to, and then it's funny that they then talk about a state standard, because if you ask them what their protocol is for X, you don't get an answer because they don't have a protocol for about mail. But then in this situation, you talk about time out of cell, and then they say, well, we're better than the state standard. So, you know, it's interesting how people use standard, you know, on a state level when it works for them, or it works for them rhetorically, and don't ever refer to any standards when they don't have any and it doesn't work for them, because they don't really want to bother coming up with any kind of policies or standards.
Can you talk about the general conditions in the jail? Would you give a sort of outline of some of the prisoners' experiences of violence, access to medical, food, and mental health resources? You've already mentioned the mental health resources being lacking, but also reading materials and so on.
I don't know that I'll hit on all of those. Certainly, if folks visited our website, amplifyvoices.com, and I'm not trying to make a big plug for that necessarily, but if they visited that, they could see lots and lots of stories that are on each of those, you know, topics and their experiences with those things. And some people talk about all of them, and some people will talk about specific things. But anyway, as far as violence, I mean, we've heard lots of accounts of violence by COs or DOs on inmates and nothing being done about it. And that's something I guess I should mention here, where the grievance system, and this is not altogether unique to Durham County Jail, inmates are told to put in grievances through a new kiosk system. Interestingly, the same kiosk through which they're supposed to order canteen. And very recently, I heard from a person inside that since they're on lockback, they're not able to file grievances. And then another situation or another sort of effect of this kiosk is that people feel like they put in a grievance and never answered. And some people felt like with paper, it actually there is some more accountability, where they feel like with putting it at a computer kiosk that it just goes in there and nothing ever comes out of it. But anyway, the same kiosk is where they ordered canteen, and he said that they don't hesitate to allow them to come out to order canteen if they have money on their commissary, but as far as putting grievances in, there's no time for that. That's kind of an interesting thing. As far as access to medical that people have, you know, people are previously were forced to pay $10 for any situation where they were asking medical to come and visit them and see what was wrong with them. And that actually very recently, actually this week, went up to $20 per time. So that's pretty amazing and pretty brazen to do that at this time. I don't know if it was planned previously to be enacted at this time or not, but so that's, you know, access to medical. People don't have $20, then they're not going to get looked at. So we have people who I've talked to, people who write to us, talk about situations where people should clearly be taken to the hospital and they're not even getting looked at. So as far as food, the inmates are served 2 sandwiches a day. So at lunch, they've got 3 hot meals a day, and now they get 2, or even sometimes 1, with that last meal being a sandwich, a cold sandwich, and that coming at 4 o'clock, between 4 and 5. And then they don't get food again until 6 in the morning at the earliest. So a sandwich is not really enough to really survive on. And so it's sort of, and people know this, they're being driven to order canteen through the commissary that's run by Aramark, so that Aramark can make big money on them. So that's, you know, one of the situations with food. We actually, in Inside Outside Alliance, we organized a call-in day in response to the change to sandwiches being served for dinner. And we did that in response to what people were writing to us. And we did that back in November. And as far as reading materials, previously so library has never been real strong at the jail, from what I know. That is, people able to go there, visit there once a month at most, and oftentimes kind of whisked in and whisked out. But with the lockback, people haven't been able to go to the library at all. So for a while, people were able to get books sent to them through Prison Books Collective, which is a group that sends books to prisoners in North Carolina, as well as people in the Durham County Jail. And for a while, people were able to get books in that way. But during this time, in the past 3 or 4 months, it's suddenly been stopped that people were allowed to get books. And now it's supposedly that people can only get, they can only get new books. And no reason has been given, and no justification for that has ever been given. And then in the media, like I referred to before, the head of the jail said that people are only allowed to have 5 or 6 books. And in another situation where she wrote to lawyers for a group, she said that people were allowed to have 3 to 4 books. And so there's kind of varying stories on that. And then, you know, we've heard that people aren't allowed to have any books at all.
So you just mentioned Aramark in that last statement. And I know Aramark's been a problem at other facilities around the country. And this is a continuing thing that I've heard from activists and prisoners at different facilities or around different facilities, that privatization of services at their prison or jail has been a problem. Is that the case here? And if so, what are some of the companies other than Aramark that are contracted with, and what's resulted?
Aramark Correct Care Solutions is the company that's contracted to do medical. And it's been, you know, I mean, you have people paying $10 and now $20 to get seen. So that's, you know, one of the negative effects. Then you have TouchPay, you know, getting money when people put money on their loved ones' commissary. There's a window that's open, and it used to be open for long periods during the day, and now it's only open for 2 to 3 hours a day, 3 days a week, where a person could actually bring cash and put money on the person's commissary. Otherwise, they're welcome to come in to lobby at any time and use the TouchPay kiosk, in which they can also pay $5.20-something in order, you know, each time they put money on the account, they're also paying for the convenience of doing so. You can also do that from home or wherever you have internet access. And so people are putting a lot of their money into money on their loved one's commissary, but they're also putting a lot of money into companies like TouchPay and Aramark's pocket. So the privilege of being able to have their loved one get looked at or have a swole because they're too hungry to get through the night because they had a sandwich for dinner. At some points, there's been some inmates in work pods who have done some of the work to put food out and, you know, get food on trays for people. And then they also decide that, you know, for the commissary, so people paying for chips and all that kind of stuff that they're paying for, they're getting to Aramark too. So, and Aramark are guaranteed that a certain number of inmates will be in the facility at a given time. And so if it's less than, I should have the number on the top of my head, but I think it's 470, but I'm not positive. If it's less than a certain number, then the jail actually has to pay them a certain amount more because they're not having the opportunity to basically gouge enough people for their wonderful food services and other things that they sell. As part of a contract, basically, they're guaranteed that they'll have a certain amount of people in the jail at any given time. And if you look at the inmate population, it doesn't ever go below that number. And it sort of stays pretty steady, you know, between 500 and 550 or so. And I think that's purposeful on the part of the county in order to meet their requirements of their contract with Aramark.
We're speaking with Steve from the Inside Outside Alliance about the current situation at the Durham County Jail in North Carolina. What sorts of pressure have been applied against the jail and the sheriff's department from within and without the jail? And how has it been received by authorities and the media?
So specifically in regard to the lockback situation since early March, because I can speak at length about, you know, pressure that's been put on in different ways by different people in different pods, even who have been who I've tried to organize in the past, but specifically in regard to the lockback, you know, people have tried to file grievances, but they don't have a whole lot of time to file grievances, and then they feel like, you know, kind of goes in a dark hole and never, you know, never sees the light of day. One pod, 4D, and I'll give a shout out to people in 4D because, you know, they sent lots of people cards saying thanks for being out there for us when we've protested. But they kicked their doors in order to try to drive the CEOs insane, maybe. I'm not sure exactly, but this is a time-honored tradition, I think, in facilities all around the country and the world of kicking doors. And they kicked their doors. And, you know, you might say, well, you know, how is that pressure? Well, I think, you know, many people would see that as something that people can do. But what it ended up happening was the people on 4D had their shoes taken away from them. And then from what we've heard, taken away, never to get it back. And the jail has sold them off, sold the shoes away. And so they're never going to get their shoes again. And what people have, folks on that pod have been told is, you know, you can buy them another pair of shoes. But so anyway, those are some of the things that people on the inside have done. I mean, I think another thing that people have done is write letters to their loved ones, write letters to our group to try to get word out about what's going on inside. And, you know, that's a pretty brave thing to do. So to, you know, speak their mind about what's going on inside. So those are some of the things that people on the inside have done. As far as people on the outside, we've come together, and in mid-April, we had a first protest. It was part of a day of action. So we had a call-in day where we called jail officials, the county commissioners, and the county manager's office. Tried to get as many people to do that as possible. And then on the same day, we had our first jail protest. It was on a Friday, so it was a day where there was no visitation, so there was no chance of visitation getting compromised. And we had our first one that day, and then since every Friday, we've had a protest outside of the jail and to varying sizes. And sometimes we march all around the jail, and sometimes we just kind of walk around and try to see as many people on different sides as possible. And obviously, the sizes have varied, but on May 1st, on May Day, there was a solidarity march with Baltimore that met up with the jail protest. And so, as you can imagine, that was a bigger one. But we've been out there every Friday, and, you know, folks who have people inside and people inside have, you know, wanted to see us out there. So we're continuing to do that weekly protest, basically until the lockback, at least, has been eradicated, and people are allowed out of cell for more time. But beyond just the protesting, we did a call-in day to the county commissioners. They knew what was up. They knew what was going on. We went to one of their meetings, and we actually, you know, mildly disrupted, or not mildly, but it was not prolonged. We disrupted one of their meetings with chanting, and the lockback ended now. And that was back in late April. And then just this past Monday, we attended a county commissioner's budget hearing where there are a lot of folks who were there talking about school budget and getting cut. And we were there saying, well, we weren't proposing any, you know, solutions. We were just saying, well, don't give the sheriff the money that he's asking for. He's asking for money to make jail cells more suicide resistant, which begs the question, why are people wanting to commit suicide, especially recently? So we were saying, you know, don't give him the money that he's asking for, but also generally people were speaking about the lockback situation. So those are some of the things that we've done in response. And then I think you asked about authorities and the media. I mean, authorities have had to they've had to respond to what we were saying, and they have. You know, there's been media stories about this where basically there never would have been anything. People wouldn't know about it, wouldn't be on TV or in newspapers. Interestingly, in a news article in the piece of crap paper that comes out every day in Durham, the Herald Sun, there was an article about the commissioners talking to the sheriff about his budget request. And it was interesting because many of the things that they were asking the sheriff were things that they've been said directly from us. Kind of a weird situation where they were clearly only knew about these things through the pressure that's been put on by people who have been protesting and disrupting their meetings and writing to them and all that kind of stuff. So as far as media, I mean, they're generally clueless. They just follow a story, and sometimes they don't. And, you know, they're kind of spotty and all over the place and don't really know what they're doing. And I'm not trying to be...
Jeez, I'm actually really hurt by what you're saying as a member of the media. Oh. I'm just kidding.
I don't mean... I mean general mainstream media is what I was referring to. And, you know, we try to make our own media, but I was just talking about, you know, daily newspapers. I will say, though, the Indie Week has covered, so the Independent Weekly, which covers the Triangle, just last week ran an article about the situation. The writer didn't know about it previously, and seems like he'll probably run a follow-up, a more comprehensive article, so I'm encouraged by that. But there hasn't been a whole lot as far as, you know, TV kind of just follow a big protest, and if it's not, you know, big and certain things happening, then they don't really care about it. So, and there's no investigative journalism going on. You know, we're doing that kind of stuff, and maybe the person from the Independent will.
So the website for the Inside Outside Alliance poses some interesting demands for reforms. Among the issues not already addressed in this conversation include the idea of pod councils, bail abolition, and the prioritization of employment by the counter of formerly incarcerated and convicted individuals. Can you talk about these demands and the general decarceration push that Inside Outside Alliance is pushing, and how does it differ from abolitionism?
I like to think of the demands as I call it a statement that we made. And if you look at it, the end part of it kind of says, you know, this is what we're saying right now. It shouldn't be taken as the sum total of what we want. And, you know, basically he says we want more people to be involved in this and to make it into more than just this. I should also say that statement was written by, it's not just an Inside Outside Alliance thing, but, you know, that's kind of quibbling. You know, there's been lots of other people who were involved in the talking about what we might write in response to what, basically it was kind of a response to, well, the sheriff is saying, we're making this better. They're allowed out of their cells, you know. At first it was every other day, and now it's every day. What more do they want? And it's kind of like we felt like there needed to be some kind of response to that, and not like you like to get into a back and forth, but there, you know, should be something that we were saying. And so that was a way of basically trying to assert a position. And so as far as the things that are talked about, I mean, lots of them are really very basic, an end to medical abuse and neglect. Inmates should have full access to writing and reading materials. I mean, I'm not sure that a lot of people would even, you know, they would think, well, of course, they would have that, and they wouldn't understand why that would even be in the statement. But in fact, that's not the case, you know, with what's going on in the jail right now. As far as some of the things that you mentioned, the pod councils, that's something that people have talked about, you know, having some kind of say over what is happening in the jail and what, you know, how how people are treated in the jail and what daily life is like in the jail. So people have talked about that in letters to us, and it, you know, I think it poses quite a radical vision as far as the bailout abolition thing. Actually, that was something that you'll notice was a kind of an add-on. They said with the clear goal of drastically reducing the jail population, these are two things that could be enacted: abolishing bail. And we linked to an opinion piece that was in the New York Times recently, calling for the abolition of bail. And I mean, the thing is in actuality, that would be quite a thing to have happen, just because it would drastically reduce the population of the jail, and something that is actually untenable for the county, right? They don't want to do that because their contracts would go up in smoke. They have to have a certain number of people in the jail. They have to be able to profit off of the inmates and their families. So in effect, it was something that was talked about and kicked around. It was kind of an add-on, as was the prioritizing the employment of formerly incarcerated people. I mean, that's something that people in the Southern Coalition for Social Justice, which is a group that is based here in the Triangle, asked for the county. You know, they had a campaign a couple years ago to ban the box, so where people weren't being asked on applications whether they had a criminal record. And that demand was kind of taking that a little farther. As far as how that is a general decarceration push, I'm not really sure. I mean, I'm for people in motion, against their oppressors and against the society around them that is basically untenable for us all to live in. And so I'm not sure that I think of us as necessarily decarcerate group, or I mean, if you look at our statement, Inside Outside Alliance's statement, we are an abolitionist group. But to be honest with you, I don't really know in practice what prison abolitionism is. And I'm just speaking as one person here, what the praxis of abolitionism is. And so, yeah, sure, it's always, you know, opposing the construction of a new facility, right? But beyond that, what is prison abolitionism? And I would argue that, and I'm not trying to take away from other people. I'm just not sure that there is a blueprint for prison abolitionism, nor should there be. I'm trying to answer the question, but also sort of rambling. But
no,
also,
not too bad, really. No, yeah, I mean, the question is kind
but
of.
But also
a,
say. I mean, I would say that prison abolitionism is preposterous outside of other kinds of abolitionism. So, I mean, outside of a context of capitalist social relations, I'm not sure that prison abolitionism makes, you know, I don't know that's a possibility. So it's something that people talk about, you know, prison abolitionism, but I feel like we're not really being entirely honest with ourselves if we're saying, well, I'm just for prison abolitionism. Well, no, you're actually for a whole new society. Sorry. I mean, I don't know. I don't mean to be flippant about it, but I'm not sure. I'm not sure that it's differing from abolitionism, but like I said, I don't know what prison abolitionism is in practice.
that's no worries. I mean, yeah. I mean, it's good to hear that answer of just like, you know, we throw out this term and like, okay, it's the new thing, run with it. And not that prison abolitionism is a new thing, but you know, it's become much in discussion, or you know, talking about the, you know, new Jim Crow, or you know, these terms and these faces go around and become more popular at different points. But yeah, it's good to tease out the question of what is this that we're actually talking about, and is this something that can actually be implemented, or is this just something on the horizon that we're like striving towards and reassessing like our praxis and like going back and trying again? I don't know. I'm all for anarchy. What the hell is that? I don't know.
Yeah, I think as far as pod councils say, I mean, when you're talking about inmates running the jail, then you're talking about people taking over the society that has otherwise been thrusted upon them, and now they're talking about running it for, we're talking about running it for ourselves. So what would be the end result of pod councils? I'm not really sure, but I think it could go in pretty great directions. So it's just something where, you know, people are putting out there. But to be honest, their inmates don't even know when they have a court date coming up. They don't even know when they're getting, you know, if they have a court date in another place, they don't know that they're going to get transferred. And so it's like very simple things being told what's happening to them. As far as the lockback and the situation around it, inmates were never officially told what was happening and what this new policy was until the night of our first protest on April the 18th. So the sheriff hadn't ever said, this is what this new policy is and why it's happening until that day. And so people didn't even know what was happening to them. And to say that people should have a say in what's happening to them is, you know, going way, way beyond, I think, what a lot of people think about. But, you know, these are things that we talked about in the grouping that's come together around this situation, and that's why we put it out there.
So how can folks in the Durham area get involved with the work against the lockback?
I mean, people could come to the protest. I mean, we want to see as many people out to the weekly protest as possible. People can, you know, sign in support of the statement that we put out. It's not necessarily a petition. It's just like putting out this statement saying, this is where we're at right now. This is what we're calling for. And so if people wanted to support that, they could support it in that way. We have regular letter writing days where we write to folks in the jail, so people could, you know, start writing to people along with us. People could follow the blog, amplifyvoices.com. People could, sounds kind of weak, but like us on Facebook or follow the group on Facebook. People can always promote what is happening, you know, the protests and whatever else we decide to do in coming weeks and months or whatever. They could promote it to other people. So, you know, just hit us up if you're in the area, for sure. We want to hear from people who are interested in what's going on. The more people that are involved, the better off we'll be.
And if folks aren't in the Durham area, do you have any suggestions for how they can start listening and amplification projects like y'all's and support for the incarcerated in their own area?
Sure. I mean, one thing that, you know, you can do is always keep an ear to the ground, you know, so to speak. But also, you know, go to the local jail or go to the, if there's a prison in your area, go there. And if you don't have someone, you know, obviously if you already have someone inside, then you're going to know what's going on. But if you don't and you want to know, then go to those places, talk to people, find out what's going on inside. If there's a way of knowing who's inside at a given time, start writing to people. You know, it's not really, there's no blueprint for doing it, but if you think that, and this is why, this is why prison abolitionism is seen as something that's really important, because it can be seen as, you know, a key social control factor in society, because as it relates to the overarching white supremacy that historically and still is a fact in U.S. society. And so if you think that it's important to be connected to folks who are in jail because you want to fight the state or you want to fight white supremacy or all of those things, or then go to the jail, find out what's happening. And, you know, I think it's important to talk to people and find out what their ideas are. And Amplify Voices has the voices of people who are inside talking to themselves about, you know, what's happening to them, but also what they think about it, what they think can be done about it. So it's pretty basic, and I think anyone can probably do it if they wanted to. So we encourage people to hit us up. Actually, some folks hit us up about how they could start a project a while ago, and I haven't gotten back to them about it because we were all in the middle of this. So anyway, I will get back to them about that, but I just said it here with you on the radio. So I encourage people to do it, and any projects that people have going on that we can learn from, we try to learn from, even though I think we all sort of do our thing on a local basis, not necessarily because that's what you think you should do, you know, locally, but that's just, you're in the grind on a, you know, day to day, and it's hard to sort of look out and see what's going on in other places sometimes, but it's really important to do. So
thank you so much, Steve, for having a conversation and sharing this information for the work that you all do.
Sure. Yeah. Thanks for, you know, for having me on.
We've been speaking with Steve of the Inside Outside Alliance about the current situation at the Durham County Jail in Durham, North Carolina. More on the project at amplifyvoices.com. Now here's a track from the German metal project, Ast, from their split earlier this year with Angst, also from Germany. The track is Von einem Ende. Lastly, we'll hear from Human Wreck with Liquid Savior from their album Catch 22. Human Wreck is from Athens, Greece.
You're listening to Asheville FM at WSFMLP at 103.3 FM in Asheville, North Carolina. This is The Final Straw. The Final Straw can also be heard on KXCF in Marshall, California, KWALP in Olympia, Washington, WCRSLP in Columbus, Ohio, KWTF in Bodega Bay, California, and Berkeley Liberation Radio.